Hello, and thank you for joining us. I'm Scott Winstead, FMI Consulting President. I'm really excited to share my conversation with Rob Fallow with you today. Rob is the president and CEO of Forest Construction, ranked 57th on ENR's most recent top 400 general contractors list. With $3 billion in annual revenue, Fortis has become a recognized leader in mission-critical and complex projects with data centers at the heart of its story. Rob's been with Fortis since its founding 22 years ago, starting as a project manager and rising through a variety of leadership roles before stepping into the CEO seat. Based out of Portland, Oregon, he's known for staying close to the work, frequently visiting project sites and engaging directly with teams. Under his leadership, Fortis has earned a reputation not only for delivering at scale, but also for cultivating a purpose-driven culture that attracts and retains top talent in a fiercely competitive market. What sets Fortis apart is its ability to balance entrepreneurial agility with disciplined strategy, making smart bets, saying no when it matters, and ensuring the culture stays strong as the business grows. In this episode, Rob and I dive into everything from the secret sauce behind Fortis' success to lessons learned through its generational transition, to how leaders can guard against cultural and operational drift amidst rapid growth. Please enjoy my conversation with Rob Fallow. Well, Rob, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for being here.
Excited to be here. My first podcast.
Oh, I'm delighted to hear that. Well, we'll make it a fun one. So would love to get us started with a bit of a thumbnail sketch of Fortis. In your own words, how would you describe the business that you have today?
Yeah, it's interesting. We're a mid-sized general contractor, but a growing general contractor. We've got over 600 employees. And what's interesting, I think, about us, we're known for being very entrepreneurial, known for being very nimble, known for having a very strong culture, known for our emphasis on relationships. So, you know, I think we're known for some of those qualities rather than just the size of work we do or the size of company that we are.
It's interesting. You kind of self-identify as a mid-sized contractor. When I see the ENR list and number 57 and $3 billion, that's probably not the image that comes to mind, but I appreciate that. I know we talked about this a little bit in our last conversation, but I'd love to kind of hear your view of the secret sauce that defines Fortis.
You know, I don't think it is horribly complex at the end of the day. When I think about what is our secret sauce, and I think there is a little bit of one, when I really think of what defines us, it is a focus on people. Back to thinking, where are you going to put your emphasis as a company? And our focus really has always been on our people. It's a culture that is lived out. You know, that's something big that is talked about a lot in companies, but we're very focused on living our culture out, not just talking about it, not just having it on our website, but living it out. And it's also a culture of a smart business discipline. You know, so I would say those three things together really comprise a secret sauce of our success and who we are today. You know, we're not trying to be all things to all people either. We're happy with who we are as a company. We're happy with our culture. And those things really do define us. If we're doing those things well, we're happy.
You know, you mentioned culture as you kind of started to talk about the secret sauce. And so I'd love to camp on that for a minute if we could. And knowing you all like we do, I mean, it's clear when you're inside, you can tell that it's more than just words on a wall, as it is in a lot of places. In our experiences, culture doesn't just happen. Would love to hear your view of how you go about shaping that intentionally inside Fortis.
I honestly think that at the heart of it, it has to be the focus, not an afterthought. And it can't be something that's done periodically or done a few times a year. It's got to be a focus every single week. And it certainly is here. If it's not, if you take a break from culture, you know, if you have other priorities that seem to rise to the top, that's when we believe you see drift. And that is something that we have really focused on intently is how do we recognize drift early and correct it so we don't get away from our culture? And that can't be done by just one or two people. It has to be something that's pervasive throughout our organization. And so that is something that we focus on significantly, is how do we recognize drift? How do we control it? How do we nudge back into the lanes when we need to? So again, it's all about focus and it's all about priorities. And we believe that that focus on culture is ultimately going to produce the results that we want in the end, not the other way around.
I can't remember where I read this, but I read something not that long ago that said, you know, treat the soft stuff as the hard stuff.
Yeah.
And I think this is certainly an example of that. But you just mentioned the word drift. And in one of our earlier conversations, you mentioned two concepts that are related. There's cultural drift and there's operational drift. I'd love it if you would maybe define those terms in terms of how you all think about them, and then how do you guard against them?
Sure. So yeah, we do look at drift in kind of two different areas, cultural and operational. And, you know, I think it's important that there is a focus on this again. And, you know, when you think about drift, we think about it as a car barreling down the freeway, clearly drifting too far off. You don't want to end up in the ditch. And so as we look at cultural drift, we really define that as straying away from our focus on culture and the importance of culture. And, you know, so how do we pulse that? We look at that in several different ways. We look at cultural drift with markers like internal surveys that we do with our employees. We look at that in terms of observations that our leaders have every day as they're leading their teams. We look at that as, you know, even as simple as words that are used, words that are being spoken or words that are being written. For example, hearing too many I's instead of we's, that's cultural drift. Using the term boss is cultural drift at Fortis. Not showing up with humility is cultural drift at Fortis. And so those are all signs. And to some degree, those are the easy signs to see. And if we recognize them quickly, we can nudge them back into the lane without having the car go in the ditch. You know, that's our philosophy, that seeing those early, having the easy conversations to correct those early, really solves for having to make a major course correction if you don't address those early. So, you know, so that's how we would look at cultural drift. Again, a lot of it's language, a lot of it's, you know, little signs that could point to us getting off tracks. And so we really try to catch those early. We had a focus group. We're big Jim Collins fans, and we have a BHAG. We have base camp milestones as we're heading to our long-term goals. And one of our base camp milestones that we've been working on for the last 5 years is focused all around cultural drift. So we had a team for 5 years work on understanding, seeing cultural drift, and how do we respond to it appropriately. It's that important to us. So that's cultural drift. Operational drift is equally as important. Operational drift is, are we straying from the ways that we know we want and need to do business, our principles of operational excellence? And those are equally as important, and equally as important to catch early. You know, so we look each month for signs that we have operational drift. And those are, again, the easy conversations to have with our project teams. Rather than, you know, at the end of a project, if we have big problems, that's when major course corrections are needed. So, you know, for us, I think the whole philosophy behind drift is, how do you catch things early and have the easy conversations rather than catching it way too late and making it a very, very difficult conversation and sometimes even impossible to get back?
You know, it's interesting, Rob, and preparing for this and connecting earlier, I did a tour of your website a couple of times, as you and I talked about, and you can certainly see it come off the screen when you interact with the website. It kind of surface level, when you kind of look at what you all put out there in terms of not just the BHAG and the values, the purpose, the manifesto. And I think you have a continuum of a couple of different idea concepts that you just shared. Boss versus captain, I think, was one, and which way you all index towards. You know, it's centralized versus decentralized. So it's interesting to see how you've got all these elements and ingredients that are woven together to create this chemistry and this culture that people feel connected to.
Yeah, we've tried to, explain our culture in a way that is understandable and that is usable on a daily basis. So we have created some different metrics, some different ways of just seeing and visualizing our culture. And we've created some of those being these scales that you just referred to. And in all honesty, that they are great ways to generate feedback and generate conversation. These are not meant to be terms that are only used by the top leaders in the company. These are meant to be used and understood by everyone in the company. That's when things are really humming. And that is really ultimately when our culture is great, is when it's being lived out. And so those terms, we want people to talk about boss versus captain. We want people to talk about a centralized company versus a decentralized company. Ultimately, we want people to know that they are empowered here, that we care about them. Those things that seem like squishy topics to discuss, we want to get out in the open. And we want people to not only understand them, but talk about them, challenge them at the same time. Are we living out our culture? Challenge me. At the end of the day, I think in my role, there can't be anything that is of higher importance than to ensure that we are living out our culture. So all of those markers, all those things that we talk about, those are the ways that we ensure we're not drifting. And again, it's not meant to be words on a website. Those are meant to be things that we live out each day with each other.
Rob, I love that answer. I'm just sitting here thinking to myself, at the pace that you all are growing and in the sectors that you're so prominent in, it's interesting because the tendency is to index towards centralization versus decentralization. And what I hear you saying is that, you know, at Fortis, we want to over-index towards the decentralization. And so as companies grow and scale, many just automatically kind of default to, we've got to just, you know, more process, more standards, more systematizing everything. There's you know, bureaucracy just to control the risk. And that's not what I hear reflected in how you talk about it. So I'd love to, if you're willing to share, go a little bit deeper on how you bring that to life.
Yeah, I would say this is one of our biggest challenges, biggest opportunities, quite honestly, at the end of the day. Our ability to stay true to our culture as we grow is not easy. And anybody that says that's easy is has not been through it. So it's extremely difficult. And, you know, that concept around how much do you try to control the risk and how do you control the risk? That's really interesting as you grow, because clearly you get more teams, more people, more clients, and more spread out. And that has been something that we look at quite often is, okay, how do we deliver consistency? How do we deliver that? How do we maintain our culture while we grow? And one of the things that is central to us, again, and I mentioned empowerment, and that word is so key to our culture. We believe, when you look at the word risk and you think about, you know, how are you taking risk as you grow, it is easy. We think the easy button is to say, well, you need to develop more processes and procedures. Just make sure that people are following a manual, quite honestly. And that way, you know that no matter where people are, if they only just follow the manual or procedures, you're limiting your risk because you know what people are going to end up doing. We look at that completely differently and say that is a massive risk if you hire smart people and you just tell them follow a manual, because essentially what you're telling them is don't think, don't use your brain, don't use your creativity. And we believe that stifles people, and the kind of people that come to Fortis, they don't want that. They don't want to follow a manual. The kind of people that come here and that thrive here really feel like they have kind of had the shackles on, maybe at other places, and that they have ideas. They have thoughts. They have things that they want to create. And so we look at it basically the opposite way, that if we don't empower our people, if we don't allow people to make true decisions, that is more of a risk than creating owner manuals and project engineer manuals and processes left and right. So, you know, back to how we honestly look at centralization versus decentralization, we want to lean more towards allowing decisions to be made where they should be made in our company. And sure, could you say that's a risk? Absolutely. Do we make mistakes every once in a while? Absolutely. But I would rather make mistakes, honest mistakes, with people who are able to make the decisions, who feel empowered, Because at the end of the day, that's going to allow them to grow as individuals. We all obviously grow, and we know this, we grow by making mistakes. And so when you don't allow people to make mistakes, I don't think you allow them to grow. And so that spirit of empowerment is huge. That's really looking at that in the way that we do, of flipping that on its head. That is honestly what has led to our growth. It's not been this tremendous business strategy that we put in place. It is unlocking the potential of our people.
One of my colleagues, whom I think you know, talks a lot about all learning happens on the edge. Being comfortable is not a recipe for development and growth. And so what you've described is a great leadership development mechanism. You empower really gifted people to, one, understand the fundamentals and understand risk, but also to make a play when they have to make a play, to use a sports metaphor. It's interesting. We could have a whole separate podcast discussion about that. I would love to shift gears a little bit, if you're comfortable with it, and maybe talk a little bit about the strategy. I think the cultural discussion naturally flows there. I would love your perspective, Rob, if you go back and maybe talk about how the firm's relationship first philosophy has opened doors or accelerated opportunities that you may not have thought you would have gotten or been qualified at that time.
Our focus on relationships has really been there from the very beginning. It's our first core value, and it's been something that has been central to just the way we look at business. And I think what's unique about it, you know, everyone can say, okay, we all believe in relationships. Being a core value and being our first core value really has put it at the forefront of everything that we do. And so I think how that has driven our strategy is that it extends well beyond our clients. I think everyone can think of relationships related to, you know, their client, of saying, hey, of course we want to build a relationship with our clients. You know, we've always looked at that and said, this has got to extend well beyond our clients, because we don't just work with our clients. We work with design teams. We work with amazing trade partners. And without everyone working together, this thing doesn't happen. And so we have really looked at not prioritizing just our clients. We've said, hey, we've got to have outstanding relationships with our design teams. We have to know what their goals are. How can we help them achieve their goals? We've got to look at our trade partners, and that term we use intentionally. The term subcontractor has been used and is understood very clearly, but trade partner is how we want to interact with them. We want them to be a partner. And we want them to know that they're a partner with us. We want them to know that we care about their success. And it's amazing when you look at a design team and you have those honest conversations. It's amazing the partnership that can come out of that. And it's amazing at the end of the day, when we work truly to help and to understand the goals of our design partners, the next thing you know, they're turning around and saying, you know, we're working on a project over here that would be great for you, and we would love to work with you on. And so we get as many project leads from our design partners as we do from our clients. And on the flip side, with our trade partners, again, we are not successful, and we cannot be successful without partnering with them. We're a general contractor, but on the majority of our projects, the overwhelming number of people out on our job sites are working for trade partners. And so we absolutely need them to be partners in everything that we do. And treating them as true partners, we believe, gets their best people, gets their best teams, gets them showing up on our job site, you know, with the right mentality. So relationships for us is not just business development. Relationships is more holistic for us. And that has been a big driver in our success.
You mentioned something in your definition of the secret sauce, or your explanation of the secret sauce, around focus. And so if we kind of stick to the strategy theme for a minute, one of the things we talk a lot about is that to be effective, strategy has to come down to saying no as much as what you say yes to. So I'm curious how you instill the discipline in the go-no-go process, or just discipline in general, to make sure that Fortis stays focused and doesn't get too far ahead of its skis.
Yeah, we are big fans of the hedgehog concept, and have bought into that from the very beginning. We're focused on the rifle strategy rather than the shotgun strategy. And you know, there's a lot of different terms for it. But at the end of the day, we believe being very intentional in the markets that we focus on is what's going to lead us to success. So it's interesting as we even look, you know, again, back to using terminology and words are important. We used to talk about projects in two different ways. We would say, hey, we have some projects that are strategic and align with our business plans and some that are opportunistic, meaning they kind of came out of nowhere and this is an opportunity. Should we address it or not? And a few years ago, we all got together and said, what are we doing here? All of our opportunities need to be strategic, not just some of them, all of them do. And none of them should be opportunistic. At the end of the day, an opportunistic pursuit usually is something that is a big shiny object, is something that looks like, wow, look at this incredible opportunity. Wouldn't this be fun? And at the end of the day, we say, well, sure, it might be, but it does not align with our business plan. So why are we doing it? And this gets back to a squishy concept of faith. And this is where every general contractor at some point in their year looks at their lead log and says, we don't have the leads coming up that we thought. Gosh, we were hoping for a project to land and it didn't. And so, geez, should we be looking outside of our business plans? Because we need to make sales. We need to keep people busy. Everyone gets to that point. And what we've chosen to do, and it's not easy, but we look at that and say, we've got to have faith that the right project in our right markets is going to come. We've got to have faith that keeping our discipline in the markets and with the clients that we want to work with is the right strategy. And over again, it comes true. A project that we didn't know about that is in the right market, it's in the zone, comes up that next week or that next month. And if we were to have pursued the opportunistic project that was out there, we would be, you know, we'd be kicking ourselves. And I'd love to say we do this perfectly. We don't. We still take on projects every once in a while that we look back on and say, gosh, I wish we wouldn't have done that. But saying no, as you mentioned, is so important. And saying no with the right reason, saying no because it does not align with our strategy, saying no because we have the faith that the right project is going to come up, that's what's important to us. So it's not easy. Projects come up that are exciting every day, but we've tried to really be universal on that hedgehog concept and say, look, we have the right strategy, stick to it. And again, it's not always easy to say no, but at the end of the day, we prize saying no for the right reasons.
Well, it's a couple things to weave in there. Obviously, it's a bit of a take on an abundance versus a scarcity mental model, right? One of my mentors long ago said that the longer you do this, you recognize that the best performing firms over the long term are the ones that view themselves as a going concern. We're going to be here a year from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now. We need to invest and make decisions accordingly versus those that look at it project to project. We're going to hire these people when we have a project, you know, and then you're always kind of chasing it. And so it's a testament to being in the right sectors and the right markets that where you know the opportunities are going to come, but also being able to have that self-discipline to know this is right down the fairway. We're a great choice for the owner with his team versus this could be more of a distraction than anything else. But it's a bit of a page of our Why Contractors Fail study from however many years ago around just that. One of the challenges that is inherent in our industry is just there is a bit of a scarcity model. I mean, it's a project-based business. There is an understandable fear that we don't know when the next one's coming, so we probably ought to take a swing at this pitch.
Yeah, that's a great point. We don't look at this as a project-based industry. Again, we look at this as a relationship-based industry. And I think when you look at it as a relationship-based industry, it's a lot easier to look at it long-term. Say, hey, this is a long-term relationship. It's certainly the abundance mentality when you're able to look at it that way. And so we preach that. And that, again, comes back to that central theme of relationships. It also is interesting when you look at that and say, how do you know that projects are going to come? How do you know that you're in the right markets? And again, that comes back to that concept of faith. We've done a lot of research. And when you work with owners and say, how are you going to be their number one choice? If you get distracted, and if we were to choose shiny object projects, we're going to work with owners when they have their marquee projects and then we're going to go away. And that's not what they want. We found over and over again that owners want us to be there, not just for their top projects, not just their marquee projects, but they're going to need a TI. They're going to need someone to swing a door. They're going to need someone to just lean on when they need it. So again, that's what a relationship is. It's saying we're here for you no matter what. We're here for you truly as a partner. And that means for the big projects and the small projects. And again, I think that is something that's been a differentiator for us and a differentiator for owners. They know that we're not going to go away. They know that we're there to serve them. And that has really been, again, a differentiator for us, because when you're doing those small projects that may not be sexy, they may not be clearly the big money makers. Those are the ones sometimes that are the most painful for owners, that they really need you for. And then when they do have those projects that are the signature projects where everyone in town shows up, they remember that we were there for them.
That's right. Exactly. Just to stay on that theme, but maybe shift in a little bit of a different direction around just building for the long term and building an enduring organization. Love to talk a little bit about this concept of the business life cycle. If you think about it, you know, really every company reaches a point where the entrepreneurial hands-on style has to evolve into something more systematic and scalable if the leadership wants it to grow. And so I'm curious how you all have experienced that and what that has looked like inside this journey.
Yeah, again, this is one of the biggest challenges we have, because as we continue to grow, we want to grow. We want to provide more opportunities for people. We all of a sudden see ourselves in multiple different states. We're working internationally, and there is a need for consistency. And that gets back to that concept of operational drift. So sometimes can that be competing, you know, needing that consistency, competing with truly staying true to our roots? And there is a tension there. And I think it's okay to acknowledge that there's a healthy tension there. We want to be fiercely entrepreneurial. Those are the kind of people that we want to attract, but we do need to evolve and mature as a company. So we are having those conversations, and they're not always easy, but saying that we want to maintain that entrepreneurial spirit, we want to and will maintain our ability to empower our employees and trust our employees, but we do have to mature as a company. We have to grow our systems. We have to look at ourselves not as a small company anymore. We have to grow to where we're going, not grow to where we are today. So there is a healthy tension there. And think that it's okay to have those conversations and have the culture where you can have those. And, you know, sometimes there's pushback of saying, hey, it feels like we're becoming too corporate in this area. It feels like we're starting to develop too many procedures. Great. That's a great conversation to have to check ourselves and say, is this the needed structure that we need to have? So those are conversations that happen quite frequently around here. And what we're starting to lean to is kind of a term that, you know, we need the appropriate structure to build for where we're going as a company. We don't need hierarchy, but we do need the appropriate structure. And why do we need that structure? We need it to serve our employees. We need to make sure that our employees who are, again, on projects around the country and around the world, we need them to have the kind of support, the kind of backbone of a company that allows them to do their job, allows them to spread their wings. So when we look at that term, appropriate structure, it's all focused on what do our employees need to succeed.
Just to pick up from there, would love to talk a little bit about succession. And as you all have moved from the founder generation to the second generation, you know, what are the biggest lessons that stand out for you and how that process went?
Succession has always been a key topic here. And I have to give credit, tremendous credit, to our three senior founders, Jim, Rennie, and David. They had succession in mind on day one. And they didn't have to. They could have focused and really put the hammer down on business philosophy, on profitability. There's a lot of different focus areas they could have had, but really from day one, they had succession in mind. They wanted to grow an enduring organization. They wanted to grow a company that would last beyond them. That's really the key reason that our company is called Fortis and not called one of their last names. They wanted our company to stand the test of time and not to really be centered on one person or three people. They wanted it to be about an idea. They wanted it to be about a culture, and they wanted it to be something that no matter who was leading the company, as long as that person and those people leading the company had the right culture, that Fortis would still be a going concern. So culture and succession kind of go together there. You have to have that right alignment between, you know, our culture to allow for succession. You have to have a culture that people want to endure for succession to work. So again, it's been at the forefront of our minds, and we look at it two different ways. You know, succession is a key word that's out there. We look at it in terms of financial succession and leadership succession. And it doesn't work if you don't focus on both of those. You know, they're equally as important. Financial succession, we have all seen companies who have struggled with it in our industry. It seems like a very common problem that companies will get to a certain point and their founders have done a great job of building a company, but all of a sudden they have not spent enough time planning for succession. And what that starts to look like is companies that end up in either a sale, end up in some kind of a dramatic company restructuring to allow the founder to get bought out, or even worse, you know, a company that just fails. And so again, to their credit, Jim Rennie and David from the beginning said, we are not going to back ourselves into a corner. We are not going to put ourselves in that position. So we worked very hard to have a financial vehicle that would allow for succession. We tested it often. We talked about it very openly. We didn't want it something that was just behind closed doors. And so we had a vehicle through our stock program that really ensured that we could have financial succession. And then as equally as important, we really worked on leadership succession. And again, they didn't have to invest the kind of time and money that they did in this. We're talking a lot of energy and a lot of money involved in truly the mentoring, the leadership development that is needed to transition a company. So this has been very intentional. It's been very intentional from the beginning. And I think it's really set our current leadership team up well to say, you know what, they helped us with this. They gave us this legacy. It is our job now to pass this on to the next generation. So we have really taken this torch and said, you know, from the beginning, we need to look at the next generation. We need to look at how are we helping them set up. That is our ultimate goal, is to have an enduring organization. And the only way we can do that is if we really focus on that financial and leadership succession from the start.
Well, there's so many things to unpack there. We would certainly subscribe to the philosophy that it is a two-pronged approach, both the financial or the ownership piece, and then there's the human piece, the leadership piece. We get a ton of calls to help firms, and I'd say more often than not, they think the math is the hardest part. We just got to lock down the financial formula as to how these shares are going to transition from one gen to the next. And that's certainly a critical part of it. But if you don't have the people, there's really nothing to do other than one of the options that you may not want.
Correct. One of the underlying concepts that really plays into both of those strategies for succession is this idea of stewardship. And this is something that we've talked about openly. And, you know, it's one of those things that you don't just flip out there and move on. It's a deep thought. And, you know, when we look at stewardship, we think of it as this concept of really not owning anything and saying, okay, if we look at ourselves as stewards of the business, that means that we don't necessarily own the business. We're holding it in trust for the next generation. And when you think of it that way, that hey, we don't really own this. This isn't ours. Our job is to make sure that when we turn it over to the next generation, it's strong, it's ready for them to succeed with. And when you think of that mentality and you really believe in that, it affects the choices that you make. It affects the strategy that you put in place. So again, you know, that term of stewardship has been important to us. It also takes out the role of ego. You're not doing this for yourself. You're doing this for other people. And when a group of people get together and really have that genuine mentality, that's when great things can happen. That's when, again, the results that come out of doing the right thing, the results that come out from concepts like stewardship are fantastic. And that's honestly where growth comes from for us, that focus on the individual, that focus on caring, that focus on empowering. We could put a strategy together and we're going to blow it out of the doors every single time if we have our focus there.
Well, there's so many things you've shared so far in this conversation that just reminds me that energy attracts like energy. Like-minded people seek each other out. So what you've described with respect to the culture, the succession philosophy, the focus on building an enduring organization and being stewards for the next generation, that's the kind of thing that will attract the kinds of people that you want to take up that mantle when it's their turn to step into those roles.
Yeah, I think one really base concept ultimately at the end of this, when you think of how are you going to attract like-minded people, we believe very strongly in purpose. And we believe we need to be a purpose-led and a purpose-driven organization, because that's what leads all of us as humans. And so we want people who want a purpose that is greater than just making money. We want people that seek out organizations that truly do have a purpose that aligns with their own. You know, we want people who challenge themselves in what is my purpose in life? Why am I here? And being okay thinking deeply about things like that. So all of these concepts that we've talked about really center around purpose. And ultimately, our purpose as an organization is to make an impact. And so the kind of people that we want to attract are people who want to make an impact. They don't want to just float along with life and let it take them wherever it goes. We want people that want to grab life and say, I'm a thinker. I have things to contribute. I have things I can do. I want to be with like-minded people so we can do great things together. And so, yes, we want people who ultimately, again, believe in purpose and believe in our purpose and see how it aligns with their personal purpose.
So refreshing to kind of hear that perspective. You know, Rob, listen, I've kept you longer than I wanted to. You've been so gracious with your time and your willingness to do this. I do have one final question, which might make you be a little bit reflective, going back 22 years or so from when you started with Fortis. But if you could go back and give your younger self one piece of advice, what would it be?
Honestly, the advice I think I would give myself is never underestimate the importance of relationships. I've talked about that. It's important to us as a company. But if I were to look at myself, certainly, you know, younger or when I was growing up, I would tell myself just never underestimate how important relationships are, both personal and professional. There's so much advice that we get growing up about what to do. You know, how do you be a successful person? How do you be successful in business? There's so much advice out there. And ultimately, at the end of the day, if you do focus on relationships and true meaningful relationships, not passing relationships, not something where you're trying to get something out of the other person, but growing true meaningful relationships at the end of the day is never going to lead you wrong. And I think we all learn that lesson sometimes the hard way through life. But I've certainly found that is the most satisfying and gratifying thing you can do is grow those meaningful relationships. So it's something that I continue to work on. It's a lifelong journey for all of us, but always leads you in the right place.
Well, Rob, thank you for a wonderful conversation. This has been a delight. Hopefully your first podcast experience was okay. We'd love to have you back anytime. And thank you again for doing this.
It's been great, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FMI's Built In and for being part of our community of leaders committed to building with intention and impact. If you enjoyed the conversation, please be sure to like, subscribe, and share the podcast so you don't miss future episodes. Until next time, I'm Scott Winstead.